You forever by Tuesday love sang Grandpa, read to you by Blue Friend, August 2016, Lesson 14. All of us are anxious to have things done for us, to have things given to us. Probably everyone would admit to having prayed for assistance. It is, of course, a natural thing in human affairs to want the assistance of someone else. Man feels insecure, alone, and wants the God, Father, image, or the Mother, image, in order that he may feel protected, may feel that he is one of a great family. But in order that one may receive, one must first give. You cannot receive without giving, for the act of giving, that attitude of opening the mind, makes it possible for you to be receptive to those who are willing to give you what you want to receive. When we say give, we do not necessarily mean money, although it is usual to give money, because that, to most people, is what they desire above all else. Money at the present time signifies security from want, relief from the fear of starvation, freedom from the visits of debt collectors. Money can be given, and must be given, under certain conditions, but give also means to give of oneself, to be willing to be of service to others. We can and must give money or goods or assistance or spiritual consolation to those who need them. Again, unless we give, we cannot receive. There is much misconception about the words give, alms, begging, and similar matters relating to so-called charity in the Western world. It seems that people imagine that there is something shameful, something degrading, in having to solicit assistance from another. But this is definitely not the case. Money is merely a commodity which is lent to us while upon the earth. It is a commodity with which we can buy happiness and self-advancement by helping others with that money instead of hoarding it uselessly in some dead stone vault. This, unfortunately, is the world of commerce, where a man's measure is taken by the money that he has in his bank and by the outward show he makes with that money. The flashily dressed man or woman who gives for his own satisfaction to build up a false facade is not a spiritual man nor a generous man. He's a man who is spending without any thought of giving. He is spending selfishly that his own ego may be bolstered. In the Western world, a man is judged by how well his wife dresses, what sort of a car he drives, what sort of a house he occupies. Does he belong to this or that club? Then he must be a man of substance, because only those in the millionaire class can belong to that club. Again, this is a world of false values, for, let us repeat it endlessly so that it sinks into your subconscious, no man or woman has ever succeeded and taken even one penny or one pin or even a spent match beyond the river of death. All that we can take is that contained within our knowledge. All that we can take is the sum total of our experiences, good and bad, generous and mean, which will be distilled down so that only the essence of those experiences remains. And the man who lived for himself alone upon the earth, although upon the earth he was perhaps a millionaire, when he goes to the other side, he will be a spiritual bankrupt. In the East, it is a common sight indeed for the housewife to go to her door at the close of day and find there the robed monk with his humble begging bowl. This is so much a part of life in the East that every housewife sees to it, no matter how poor she may be, that she has food to spare for the mendicant monk who depends upon her generosity. It is considered an honor indeed to the house that a monk should call for sustenance. But, contrary to common belief in the West, a monk is not just a parasite or beggar. He's not a shiftless man who's afraid to work and so lives on the bounty of others. Do you know what it is like, these evening scenes in the East? Let us assume that we are looking down in the East upon some country such as India, where this process of giving to the monks is common indeed, as it was in China and Tibet before the communists seized power. We are, then, looking down on a village in India. The evening shadows are falling and lengthening across the ground. The light is taking on a bluish-purplish tinge. The leaves of the baobab trees are rustling slightly as the night winds come along from the Himalayas. Softly along the dusty road comes a monk dressed in tattered robes, carrying with him all that he possesses in the world. He has his robe with sandals upon his feet. In his hand he carries his rosary. Slung across his shoulder he has his blanket, which serves him as his bed. Other small possessions are tucked into his robe. In his right hand he has a staff, not to defend himself against animals or humans, but that he may push aside brambles and branches which otherwise would impede his progress. He uses it, too, to test the depths of a river before he attempts to ford it. He approaches a house. As he does so, he fumbles in the breast of his robe and produces his well-worn shiny bowl, a wooden bowl which is aged and worn smooth with use. As he approaches the house, the door is suddenly opened, and a woman stands respectfully at the entrance with a dish of food in her hands. Modestly, she looks down, not gazing at the monk, for that would be an impertinence. She looks down to show that she is modest, demure, and of a good name. The monk walks up to her and holds his bowl with two hands. Of course, in the East, one always holds a bowl or cup with two hands, because to hold it with one hand would show disrespect to the food. Food is precious, therefore it is worthy of the attention of two hands. So the monk holds his bowl steady with two hands. The woman puts in a generous supply of food and then turns away. No word is exchanged, no glance is given, for to feed a monk is an honor, not a burden. To feed a monk is to pay, to some small extent, the debt which all lay people feel towards those who are in holy orders. The woman of the house feels that she and her house have been paid respect, that this, a holy man, has called at her door. She feels that tribute has been paid to her cooking. She wonders if some other monk may perhaps have said some kind words about the food which she's provided, and this has sent another monk to her door. In other houses, women may be looking rather jealously out from their curtain windows, wondering why they have not been chosen for the monk's visit. With his bowl filled, the monk slowly turns away, still holding the receptacle with two hands, and moves across the road, again to the shelter of some friendly tree. There he will sit, as he has sat for most of the day, and have his evening meal, the only meal of the day. Monks do not overeat. They live frugally, and have just enough to maintain their strength and their health. But they do not have sufficient to make them become gluttonous. Too much food clogs spiritual development. Too rich food or fried foods impair the physical health. And if one is to develop spiritually, one should live as the monks live. Eat enough, but no more. Eat plainly that the body may be fed, but do not eat richly, so that the mind is satiated and the spirit locked in the case of clay. It should be explained that the monk who has had this food does not necessarily feel overcome with gratitude. Through time immemorial, a way of life has arisen in the East. A monk is fed as a rite. He's not a beggar nor a burden. He's not a shiftless man nor a parasite. During the day, before the evening meal, the monk will have been sitting for hours beneath a tree, available to all who comes his way, available to all who need his services. Those who need spiritual solace will have come to him for help, as will those who have relations who are ill, or even those who want an urgent letter written. Some, too, come to see the monk, to hear if he has any news of loved ones in some far distant place, for a monk is always on the move, walking from town to town, from city to city, traversing the countryside, crossing the land from border to border. And the monk gives his service free, no matter what is wanted of him, no matter how long the service demanded takes, it is free. He is a holy man and an educated man. He knows that many of the villagers who need him and the help that he willingly offers cannot pay him, they're too poor. Wherefore, it is right and just that he has had to study for his knowledge, and as he brings spiritual consolation to people, he has not the time nor the right to work manually and earn a living. Therefore, it becomes the duty, the privilege, and the honor that those whom he has assisted shall in their turn assist him, and pay to some small extent with the food which he has to keep body and soul together. After his meal, the monk will rest a while, and then, rising to his feet and cleaning his bowl with fine sand, he will pick up his staff and stride off into the night, often traveling beneath the light of a brilliant tropical moon. The monk travels far and fast, and sleeps little. He is a man respected throughout the Buddhist countries. We, too, should be willing to give, in order that we may receive. In the days of long ago, it was a divine law that all men should give a tenth of their possessions, that good may thereby be wrought. This tenth became known as a tithe, and soon it became an integral part of life. In England, for example, the churches could levy a tithe on all property, on everything that a person possessed. This money was devoted to the upkeep of the church and provided the stipend of the incumbents of a living. It is interesting to note that some 10 years ago in England, there were a number of law cases where hereditary landlords made a great commotion in the law courts of the land in order that the tithes imposed by the Church of England should be set aside. The hereditary landlords were complaining that having to pay a tenth of their income was ruining them. Actually, they were being ruined by not giving willingly, for unless one gives willingly, it is better not to give at all. Nowadays, standards are rather different from what they were years ago. No longer do people live on tithes, nor do they pay tithes, and that is a pity. It is essential that if one is going to progress spiritually, one shall tithe for the good of others, and especially as for the good of others brings much good to oneself. In short, we can only progress and be helped if we help others. We are aware of a number of very hard-headed businessmen of no great spiritual leaning who willingly give a tenth of their income for the good of others, and more especially for their own good. They do it not because they are religious. They do it because hard commercial experience and the fact of account books have taught them that in thus casting their bread upon the waters, it comes back to them a thousandfold. Money lenders, who in some parts of the world are referred to as financial corporations, are not always noted for spirituality nor for generosity, and it seems to us that even if one of these money lender financier gentlemen has sufficient faith in tithing, then there must indeed be something very profitable in the scheme, and we know that many, many hard-headed businessmen do just this. The occult laws apply to the unspiritual as much as they do to the spiritual. It does not matter if a person studies a lot and reads a lot of spiritual books. That does not make a person spiritual. He might be just reading and deluding himself into thinking he is spiritual. The matter which he is reading may pass straight through his eyes and vanish into thin air without having once impinged upon the memory cells of his brain. Yet this person will refer to himself as a great soul and really believe that he's making progress. Actually, he is usually very self-righteous and very unwilling to help others, even though, in helping others, he would greatly help himself. We repeat again that it is right and proper and profitable that a person should give help to others. Incidentally, it is very helpful to the person who gives. Tithe means, as we've said, a tenth. It also means a way of life, because if one gives, one also receives. We have in mind, as we write, a person who has given much help, much assistance, help and assistance which cost money, time, and specialized knowledge. As fast as one trouble was cleared up for that person, other troubles descended, like a flock of starlings in a newly seeded field. We said, in order to receive, you must first give. That person was most offended, and gave us to understand that he was most generous and did everything possible to help others, as the local newspapers would attest. Our contention is that if a person has to have good deeds reported in the local newspapers, then that person is not giving in the correct way. There are many ways in which we can give. We can, in addition to devoting a tenth of our income to good work, help others in their spiritual needs, or help them by the necessary consolation when they fall upon evil times. In giving to others, we give unto ourselves. Just as a business must have a good turnover in order that business may prosper, so must we have a good turnover of giving in order that we may receive. We must give to help others. We must give in order that we may be helped. It is useless to pray that something be given to you unless you first show that you are worthy by giving to those who need it. Practice it. Practice giving. Decide how much you can give, what you can give, and how, and having worked out how and why and when, put it into practice. Try it for 3 months. You'll find that at the end of the 3 months, you are in pocket either spiritually or financially or both. Will you study this and study it again and remember, give that ye may receive, cast your bread upon the waters. End of lesson 14.